Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. And the aforementioned Sal, along with the ever genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, want to thank everybody for joining us here for a live edition of Midrats. If you're new to the show, go ahead and scroll to the bottom of the show page. There you'll find the chat room. That's a great way to stroll in with the usual suspects. And if you have some questions, especially for today, that's a great place to bring it in. But we got something a little different today. This is just Eagle One and myself, a little coffee clash without the coffee discussion. We would really like to open a broad envelope there for questions on topics that maybe we haven't covered on Midrats that you wish we had. And you can go ahead and bring that question up. You can call in if you'd like. And now if people are listening to this on the archive, then obviously you're not going to get us. So just for those that are with us live, and I'll try to repeat the phone as the show goes on a while, you can reach us at the switchboard, area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397, and of course our friends in Europe know that's country code 1, of course. Anyway, so thank you very much, and if you're new to the show as well and you want to catch up on some old stuff, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, but I also recommend that people just take the easy way out and throw up the free podcast up on iTunes, and you can get to us at your leisure. So Eagle One, we don't have any guests today, so I guess I'll say hi to me and say hi to you.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to have you here again.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever had the chance to do this, but we might as well go ahead and tip it out that if you don't follow Eagle One and myself on Twitter, you really ought to. Mine's cryptically CDR Salamander. And Eagle One, is yours at Law of the Sea, or what is your Twitter handle?
You know, I have no idea.
I follow him, so people go to at CR Salamander and look at the few people that actually follow Eagle One's one of them. It's Law of the Sea, Eagle Speak, it's something or another.
Yeah, it's at Law of the Sea. Law of the Sea.
There we go. Hey, I've seen the chat room. We already have Ken and Paul and Saturn Five there. Just a reminder to those usual suspects and the other ones, as they do filter in, if you wanted to get rid of your stage fright, your counselor might let you do that. You can call us at area code 347-308-8397 and ask us your questions directly. Country Club, country code 01 for our friend S5 in Turkey. Hey, while we're on speaking about that side of the world, kind of what I wanted to talk to you about some today, kind of kicking off, and what maybe pimp out our Twitter accounts is, I read something earlier today from our friends over in Canada at the Global Research on Globalization. I don't know how big an organization they are, but they do have some pretty neat stuff. You can read up there at globalresearch.ca. I don't know if our buddies, our Canadian buddy is part of that. I doubt it, but he should be. But they had a really interesting article there that touched on something that I was not aware of. I had a vague idea. Yeah, that was part of France's historical part of the world in Mali. But what was really neat is at the very tail end of the colonial era in the late 50s, the French had an area they defined in the Pan-Sahel, however you want to pronounce it, part of the Sahara and the southern part of that, that was an economic zone of influence that they were trying to, even as they were planning on decolonizing, to maintain their influence on. And recently there was U.S. AFRICOM had an interesting little PowerPoint slide in it that when they mapped out their area for the Pan-Sahel initiative, it almost overlaps exactly what the French had in 1958, and it overlaps the terrorist area. And it discusses a little bit the rather unappreciated mineral and economic assets in that area that China is interested in. And it was an interesting article, and you find the link up on the chat room if people haven't already. And if you point it up late and like to see the link again, just let me know in the chat room and I'll fold it in there. But they brought in the economic tie-in, but I think it also brought in a couple interesting things about the long war. That's also the bleeding edge of militant Islam and where the franchises of al-Qaeda are pushing through. It's a little bit to the north of the real bleeding edge that we see in Nigeria in a few areas. So you have a few things working here. You have the historical interest of the French. You also have the economic interest of the Chinese. And you have the larger bleeding edge of the expanding part of the fundamental Islam all rolled up together in one nasty little part of the world. And when France moved in there, I also thought it was intriguing that they wouldn't be able to do what they did without U.S., U.K., I think the Dutch and also the Danes gave them a lot of support to transport their forces, which also, incidentally, the Dutch, the Danes, the Brits, not so much the French, were the first ones to come to our help in Afghanistan a little over a decade ago. A question I just wanted to kick off with you, that background, Eagle One, is looking at it, the French are now moving into that little touchy phase that we've moved in as to lead power in two places, and that is they want to move into counterterrorism, counterinsurgencies. Does it look like the French may make the same mistakes that we made, or are they going to do what might be smart, which is smash, put up a couple of people, and then leave? What do you think, there, Eagle One?
Yeah, I think they've had considerable experience with some of this stuff, you know, going back 50, 60 or more years in Algeria and other exotic spots. And I think their normal thing is to run in, kill a bunch of people, kind of set up a status of where they can get out, and then they get out. If they have to go back, well, they'll do that. But I don't see them making a mistake, not since Vietnam, of spending a long time there trying to fight a big glob of bad guys.
Yeah, I also don't think they have the political will or the financial ability to do that. But so far, I think you got to give credit to both sides. The French have done a pretty good operation. They don't have any of their traditional allies stabbing them in the back in the international arena or talking them down. I've also read some stuff recently. Al-Qaeda, this is not their first rodeo. And they've done the usual, we'll bleed into the background, let things get settled, and then start cutting you off at the knee. So I think that'll be interesting to see whether the French can get the Mali forces in a position where they can push back against the Taurus. But I think the U.S. is right and should continue to support the French as much as possible because we've got some responsibility for what's going on in Mali. The Tuaregs, which have been a thorn in everybody's side there, from what I've read, for as long as the Pashtuns have been a pain in the side in that part of their part of the world. And in the last decade, we've trained a lot of them, and they've gone to the other side. The operations in Libya that we backed had a second-order effect of arming them, some rather significant weapons. It would be very interesting to see what direction the French take over the next couple of months, because one way or another, I think we're going to have to support the French, hopefully not with any boots on the ground per se, but just with what we've been doing at this point. Can you think of any that part of the world, from the Sahara on south, has there really been any successful training operation of Western forces with sub-Saharan African military forces to be able to do an effective job? I think in Uganda they've been doing a little bit of good. But besides that, doesn't have much of a track record, does it?
No, I think it depends on what you look at, what area of the world you look at. I mean, Morocco has been fairly stable. But I'm by no stretch of the imagination a sub-Saharan African expert. But there's a lot of YM has been is there and growing. And as you said, we managed to turn loose a bunch of well-trained Libyan people and other forces that have gone down there and tried to establish themselves. And it's going to get more and more exciting as we go along.
Yeah, history doesn't like to be ignored. That, and again, that's one of the things that I enjoyed about that article that I read on Mali and AFRICOM, is the echoes of what's been done before. And as we see in many things, it's that consistent repeat of interest, economics, power, and unfortunately, in this case, we have religion thrown in as well.
Yeah, I think we're just going to have to kind of wait and see in that area. When at least the French are the leading edge, and they have some capabilities and some assets that we would be reluctant, I think, to the field. But out with the transport and stuff. Now, speaking of which, though, as we run up to the end of the month, and again, we all know the beginning of next month starts the great sequester issue of 2013. We've got some questions about that in the chat room, and I know we want to talk about it. I put up a link to the CNO's letter sent down to his lower echelon people about what they needed to not do, which pretty much cuts out training and a whole bunch of other stuff. And then we get into, you and I discussed this briefly offline a week or so ago, but how much of what, in your view, how much with the announcements of things we're going to have to cut out, the cancellation of the Truman deployment, so how much of that is the political side of the Navy trying to say, hey, you can't, this is not smart? Much of it is just an acknowledgement of the realities of Congress unable to agree on what should happen.
Yeah, and you and I talked at the show, and I keep second guessing myself about this, but I do have a concern, the fact that it all appears to me that this is we're a little bit too much of D.C. as opposed to being in D.C. This has all the markings of an info ops and, dare I say, almost psyops operation against our own people. This sequestration should not have been a shock to anybody. And there's some great timelines and some great articles out there to discuss this in minute detail. But the sudden panic and push, did anybody really think that this wasn't going to happen? And if they didn't, where was their branch plan in the case they did? And it's like panicking on the 15th of April because you've got to pay your taxes. I think part of the problem might be, and I've whined about this in the past.
Wait a minute. You're not supposed to panic on the 15th of April because you haven't paid your taxes?
No, you'll have sympathy for me.
You mean
let your wife do it all. Very important.
I'm doing this wrong.
There we go. There's always ways to do it. I think there's a little bit of politics involved in it that makes it uncomfortable. I understand why they're doing it. We need to make sure that everybody knows the impact of these cuts. We need to make sure that people pressure their congressmen. I don't know if that's really a good idea for the military to do. I understand why they're doing it, but adding to the everything is a crisis, I don't care much for at all. It's only a crisis and panic if you make it that way. And you've been around this rodeo before. Especially in the 1970s, there were significant problems and issues. When you look at the budget for the last 12 years, sequester should be a little more manageable if you're not waiting to the last minute and you have to understand programs. I understand this is also a lot of people's livelihoods. A lot of our listeners are involved in defense contractors. Some of them are, you know, actually contract people attached to DOD, DOD civilians, yard workers, and this is their livelihood. And it reminds me in some ways for the local government whenever there's a budgetary challenge. The first thing they do is come, we're cutting police and we're cutting firemen. They're not discussing the fact they're paying the school board, basically the school board's PAO, $100,000 a year. They don't discuss all the other things in the budget, like spending $50,000 for a senior's prom, seniors as in people over 70 and things like that. I think there'd be a lot more credibility if we didn't immediately do the Navy version of we're cutting the firemen, we're cutting the police. If we really, really did some serious things that said, okay, we know we're in a new budgetary environment. We know sequestration is going to bite. But here's a few of the things we're going to do. It'd actually be a great opportunity to cut some staffs, both in number and in depth. I understand why they're doing it, and I understand the realities of getting jerked around when these things take years to get in play. But the way it's being done and the panics and the notification part, to me, smacks a little bit of info ops and psyops against our own people. That's just distasteful to me.
Well, that kind of raised that issue that there was a blog young officer on the Naval Institute blog suggesting that this level of crisis has now risen to the point of the USS United States and that the revolt of the admirals back in the late 40s, early 50s, I guess, and suggesting that some FOGOs, flag officers and general officers, ought to resign to let Congress know how serious they are about this issue. I'm not a big fan of that idea. I don't think this comes anywhere near that. I think there are times when you should resign if you're being ordered to do something that you know is stupid and is going to get people killed. There may be a time to say, no, I'm opting out of this. But I don't think this rises to that level. What do you think about it?
I'm directly with you on that. Completely aligned with your thoughts there. The only time an officer should resign is if he has been given an order he cannot legally, morally, or ethically carry out. And he needs to be very open about it and very direct about it. And I know the article of which you speak, and they were strictly saying that it should just be general officers and not company grade or field grade. No, that attitude, from my point of view, it goes for every type of officer, whether commissioned or warrant or senior NCO. If there's a political problem and you get caught in that political problem, no. I'm a firm believer, like the last of the Roman legions. You man your post on the Danube until Rome burns and falls, and then they're not being paid anymore, and then you find something else to do with your living. You've got to stay out of politics. Let the politics work out amongst itself, especially sequestration. Congress put it up. The president supported it. It was really the president's idea, and Congress ran with it. The fact that in all form of government, the legislative and the executive branch are at loggerheads in our argument, that's not a bug in the system that is worth resigning over. That's a feature. Our government was designed to be ugly, contentious, relatively inefficient. If I hear one more person talk about inefficient sequestration, I was like, okay, let's explain. Let's talk about how Pinochet ran a military budget in a dictatorship. There's efficiency for you. We should accept this as part of being a representative republic, this design to have inefficient central government. And that's, again, I think a feature, not a bug. and accept it that this is just part of the process. And if your job and your livelihood is affected, or if you're in uniform and you get asked a question, they want to clear with your PAO, respond with facts, respond calmly, and defer to the politicians because they own the money, they own your backside. Don't get involved with their business. The politicians will work it out. And if they don't, well, you know, improvise, adapt, overcome. We'll do the best that we can. We've been gobbled in so many worse places than this right now. And our defense budget is fine. And it's going to contract. And if we're not already planning for efficiency or what needs to be cut, then that's bad on us. We talked about this a lot. The tea leaves were able to be looked at half a decade ago, where this was going. The only question was what degree. And I find it's a little disingenuous for people inside the Beltway to have to reach for smelling salts. If they're really that shocked and that surprised, then maybe they should resign because I've lost confidence in them that this is really a shock.
Well, that reminds me of the other topic. Speaking of Secretary of Defense nominee Hagel, kind of twisting in the wind right now. You know, you and I have interviewed at least once, and you know, and we've spoken to a number of secretaries and former undersecretaries and people like that. And you know, you need a very sharp individual to be running this large, complex defense structure. And in your view, I mean, I'll come out and say I don't think Hagel's the guy to do it. There's some things to admire about him, but I'm not sure he's the sharpest tool in the box. And I don't, you know, there are other people who that we've talked about before who I think would be better candidates. What say you about Mr. Hagel, and how is his nomination going to, if he gets it, going to play into this defense funding issue?
Well, I think, and I don't care where you are on the political spectrum, I was not impressed with Hagel to begin with when he first announced as a candidate. One, because he's been wrong on so many things. In the last decade, he was wrong about the surge in Iraq. Plus, I don't hide the fact that I am I'll use a real incendiary term. I am a Zionist. I'm very pro-Israel. If you are against Israel, then I'm on the other side of the fence. I'm very clear about that. And I could do a four-hour dissertation on that, no reason to. I don't care how you spin it. Hagel is, at best, anti-Israeli. At worst, he has some issues with Jews. People like that are immediately discounted for me, full stop. I have no use for that. That's originally why I was against Senator Hagel. He's just, in my opinion, wrong, and he would be a distraction because he has a lot of things that have nothing to do with efficiently managing the Department of Defense. I think his two predecessor goes, Gates, I think will go down history as one of the best Secretary of Defenses we have ever had, full stop. I think John Panetta, he had a good background. You know, he was a very partisan Democrat, but he was an honorable man. He was a politician, but he was a politician, I think, in the good sense, whether you agreed with the politics or not. I think he did an admirable job serving the president that appointed him as Secretary of Defense, and I'll give him that credit. Hagel, however, I'll let the tenfold people decide why they nominated and are sticking with him. Because once he went up in front and testified, that was a complete dog's breakfast of a testimony. You take almost anybody I can think of who was in the top 10 list would have been able to perform better in front of that hearing. If he can't perform that way and explain his positions well enough in that environment, then he's in no position being the Secretary of Defense, because people are going to rely on him to be able to process information and communicate it clearly. Epic failure on his part. That in and to itself should dismiss him. I think it wasn't really excessively partisan. You have Senator Graham of South Carolina. You have Senator McCain of Arizona. And when you have Senator Ayotte in New Hampshire, these are not radical right-wing Republicans, phone-flecked people on the far right. These are completely center-mass of the country, left-of-center Republicans. And I thought they all did an exceptional job, as did Senator Cruz of Texas, putting out there that Senator Hagel is not the best person for the job. I've disagreed with some of her things before, but I think there are other great candidates out there. A lot of people talk about Michelle Flournoy. I think she would be great simply because she has a curious intellect and what I've seen, an open mind, and she knows things as one should. Senator Hagel also has no problems with cutting Department of Defense even further than I would. I made no mystery the fact I believe all operational forces should be withdrawn from Europe and from Japan. I think the four deployed naval forces we have in Japan are probably okay. I think the majority of the ground forces should be long gone, unless they're involved in some combined logistics or training base like we have Grafenwehr over in Germany. I think that's fine. I think we can get by on a smaller defense budget if we're not going to be involved in land wars in Asia anymore. We've talked about that in detail, but I think Hagel, his bias is a little bit too far. And I got the impression from this morning, if you watch, I made the mistake of watching some of the Sunday morning shows, and I think the press has done a horrible job as well. They're attacking John McCain because McCain had the temerity to do his constitutional duties. I quit watching Sunday shows on a regular basis years ago. I quit watching them when I went to Europe, and I tried to when I watched them again when I came back, and I made the mistake of trying to watch them again. They're just, I don't know what's going to take to fix the U.S. press. But McCain said he thinks that Hagel will probably pass, and if he passes, then I think the good people in, under him in civilian outfits and in uniform have to take a deep breath, advise him the best they can, know what they can positively affect, know what they can't, and just try to do the best to take care of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marine and Coast Guardsmen that are involved with, because this too shall soon pass, the civil reign of Hagel, whether he lasts 1 year or whether he makes it all to 2016. Knowing Hagel and his mentality, though, I wouldn't be surprised if Paul Lehman was gone in less than a year because he couldn't take it. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I'm kind of reminded of Les Aspin, and for those who don't remember, Les Aspin, he was a Wisconsin Democrat who became Secretary of Defense. He was but he was forced after, I'm characterizing it as a forced resignation, after the Somalia Black Hawk incident, when it became it vetoed sending of additional armor or some kind of armor to the area on the behalf of the U.S. And a lot of people blamed the absence of that equipment for the slow response that caused more death among the Americans and some other decisions which indicated that he wasn't, he had not acted in the best interest of the troops. And in any situation, your defense obligation is not to act in the best interest of the troops. You've got to make some tough decisions, but most people don't think that decision was particularly hard. What I am concerned about with Mr. Hagel is that I don't think he's a strong, potentially strong defense secretary, and I question whether, when he went to the hearing, whether he just didn't have anybody prepare him for the hearing, or whether he's difficult to train, You know, you, if you were a former flag aide or if you've ever done any preparation work for getting somebody ready for hearing or a trial or whatever, you know, you spend hours with these people trying to get them to understand the questions they're going to get asked and have appropriate responses or be able to slide. If they don't like the question that's asked, be able to slide to the answer they want to give. I saw none of that in his case. He looked like, from moment one, deer in the headlight, and it's very troubling. And I've had witnesses, senior executives in companies who just would not listen to advice on how they should testify, and they end up in the hands of a good lawyer on examination. They can look pretty goofy. That's kind of what I saw. The other part of it is, if he's defense secretary, and then we have, much to my surprise, as a Vietnam-era veteran who bought a little bit off the coast of Vietnam, we have John Kerry as Secretary of State, which, you know, the cycle of nightmares for me of things that could go wrong in our government. But you know, I mean, I'm sure the Republic will survive, but it's difficult. So that's kind of where I come down on it. Any other thoughts on there, or should we move on to a different topic?
You know, I just want to throw one more log on that fire, because you just remind, and you were exactly right. It's always, and sometimes, you know, there are things like poor Senator Rubio in the water. I'm mad at his staff. That's just poor staff work. You gotta help the guy along. But you can also tell a lot when you have somebody. And I had a couple guys in the Pentagon say, you know, the weekend after Hagel went up there, was everybody, it was all hands on deck. One of the important things about a senior leader is he has to be able to leverage the power of the people on his staff that know more than he does, and that they have the personality they can go to him. It's like, hey, listen, you're the genius on this. You need to get what you have in my brain as much as possible, and has to be able to inculcate that knowledge and then do something with it. And if you can't do that, like he did, he tells me one or two things. Either he was so arrogant that he didn't reach out and say, hey, people need to get smart, let's get work, or that was done and it didn't sink in. Secretary of Defense has to take a lot of imperfect information and probably some wrong information mixed in with some right information, digest it, look at the five people who are looking at him for answers, be able to give them an answer, and then turn over to the commander-in-chief who's looking for him to be able to boil that down to the essential importance. And if you don't have a nimble mind and an open mind, it's not good for this republic. And you mentioned Senator Kerry as Secretary of State. You know, the republic will survive, I guess. The people in Massachusetts owe the entire country an apology for that guy. But you know, not everybody sees the world through my prism. One of the prisms I would like to talk about. This is fun. I feel sorry for anybody underage. See for the JOs. Anybody under age 45 really didn't appreciate how, in some ways, fun the Cold War was. And why it was fun, when you had the incidency agreement, when you deployed, you were going out against the Soviets who were deploying to, and the Russians, bless their hearts, they're really good at some things, and they were just on the JV team in some areas, but anybody that had a scrimmage against the JV team knows exactly a lot of fun. And we have the Russians in the last few years, as their resource-based economy has helped them out, they started to play again. We saw a little bit of heavy breathing about some Tu-95s doing a long-range navigation training flight around Guam and flying back. I know the F-15 drivers, they're probably piddled in their pants with fun being able to actually do an alert launch and pull up on a bear. They've been flying around a lot near the Alaska aid is. And I think Russia, I don't get any reason for people to be fearful about them per se, but I think a lot of what we're seeing now It's not directed at us anyway. I think it's for internal consumption. I think it's the post-Soviet Russia. They have a lot of wounds that need to be licking, a lot of egos that need to be reimbursed. So we're probably going to see more of them in the air and on the seas after showing the flag to help build up what is probably a national ego that needs to build up. I welcome them. You can't buy training like that. If we can get through sequestration to do intercepts, it'd be great. But I think, hey, come on back. Let the generation of sailors and airmen go out there and play with the Rogers like we used to. I think it's great. You can't unscripted training like that. It's beautiful.
I thought what was interesting was how it was covered. I mean, the media, which of course knows nothing about.
Eagle One, you there? Hello? Eagle One?
Hey, that was your chance.
You faded out, and then you came right back.
I faded out, and then I came back.
Yeah, you're gone for about 5 seconds. It's not like you're talking to the tube. Or maybe it's me. Hey, guys in the chat room, are y'all here in Eagle One, or is this of the problem up end?
Hello?
Yep, I got you.
Okay.
It must be a meteor.
Must be me.
Yeah. Paul said five said they were having trouble here. Yeah. You're in and out. So you're in. But last thing I heard from you was something about the media. Going once. Going twice. I want to go ahead and hang up and then dial back in. Oops, I think he's already done. And while I'm waiting for Eagle One to come back, I'll kind of build off that. There was also a couple of articles out recently. It's beautiful. I hope it breaks beyond the ambient noise. That concerns the Renaissance and the requirements for ASW, which Eagle One's back. Maybe we'll count that back. Eagle One.
Can you hear me now?
There we go.
Can I have to go?
Beautiful. Okay, let's pick up. You said something about the way you were interested and how the media was covering the Russians.
Yeah, they don't. You know, I was saying the media doesn't know anything about the aircraft. So they one of the headlines was Russian aircraft carrying nuclear tipped missiles approach Guam, and you know they have no way of knowing that. Nobody has any way of knowing that. But then I read a much more in depth piece someplace, and they talked about how this thing had been tracked. The planes have been tracked all the way from Russia down to off Guam, and that there had been a couple of in-flight refuelings. It was obviously a training flight. Guam is as good a place to go anywhere as any place if you're going to do one of those long missions. But I just thought the media coverage was interesting because they were all excited about it, and then they questioned the timing because it was on the same day as his Union address, and I of course thought that because of the meteor. Declare that was obvious that maybe the Russians were responding to that. So
what's one of my favorite quotes from Hunt for Red October? Got to give Tom Clancy some credit for this. The Russians don't take a crap without a plan. I'm sure this was planned out a long time ago. You know, weeks. They don't give a flying. You know what about our State of the Union? It's a great that route right there. That's great long range navigation. You know, you can do a little bit of celestial navigation in route. Got a nice radar turn. You can do some radar fixes and practice aerial refueling. It was probably a great opportunity for the combined operations center that we have with the Japanese to coordinate that travel across the Western Pacific. So, hey, I think they should do it on a quarterly basis to help readiness numbers. Everybody can get a little bit out of it. So, not too bad. Not too bad.
Well, I think we need more. I think we need more kooks worrying about things like our ability to control meteors and the weather out there spreading rumors about every natural disaster is the fault of something the U.S. has managed to manipulate.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive. video of the media that hit Russia. You know, a lot of people wonder why there were so many dash cams and video of that meteor, which, you know, nobody could plan for. The reason is dash cams in cars are very, very common in Russia and a lot of the former Soviet Union, but mostly in Russia, because it's the only way you're going to get compensated if somebody hits your car. No offense to our friend Saturn V, but they almost drive as bad as the taxi drivers in Istanbul, which are on par with the Italians, southern Italians, when it comes to driving ability. So unless you have video of somebody who's actually hit you, you're going to have to suck it up and get it, pay for it yourself. So there are a lot of people who have dash cams going for their own defense in case they get in a car wreck. So that's why we saw. But you think about a meteor like that and get 1,000 people injured by glass. That's a very – everybody go to Google Earth and look where it took place. It's the middle of nowhere. But you have a meteor like that do the same thing over Western Europe, coastal China, the eastern seaboard off California. That's going to create a mess if for no reason, just the damage. What do they say? It was 20 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb when it popped off or something like that?
Something like that. I'm convinced that since Iran ruled its top secret stealth fighter aircraft thing actually carries meteors, and probably the Russians ought to be looking toward Iran for especially since, as you described it, it's a Potemkin jet anyway. So, but I'm having fun with Iran and their weapons revelations, but. I think we ought to be pointing the finger at them for this particular incident.
I agree. The Iranians, you know, talk about doing things for internal consumption. We had a guest on a while ago, and I think we both read about it, that the in that part of the world in Southwest Asia, the country that America's a factor in is in Iran. A little bit of a disconnect between the Iranian people and their government. But they are very much almost North Korean and Soviet in some of their just plain cheesy propaganda, as fake as can be. You got to wonder who's running their shop, because it's just not impressive. I guess they're trying to impress their own people. I really don't know. But the Iranian situation, I think what's going to be interesting to watch over the next 5 years is, and a lot of it depends on how much the Western Europeans will win on the fracking bandwagon, but technology has made it such that the Iranian fuel is mostly going to be needed by India and China, not so much Western Europe, North America, between U.S., Mexico, Canada, and a couple of our friends further south. You know, the Western Hemisphere can almost take care of itself from a petroleum point of view. As India and China start to assert themselves, it'll be interesting to see how they start to interface with the Iranians more and more. I know it's always entertaining to have the U.S. as the great Satan, but if we start shrugging our shoulders more here, there, and yon, be interested to see how the Indians and the Chinese will deal with the Iranians, or will they strictly have a mercantile relationship and not care how many Potemkin weapon systems they push out there? I guess that would just wind up being worry of the Sunni Iraqis and the Saudis. Eagle One? Eagle One, talk about it again. Let's see, I haven't looked at the old chat room. Just remind everybody, if you want to call in, you got 15 more minutes. Area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397, if you want to call and ask us a direct question. But as I wait for Eagle One to call back in, which I think he is right now. Third time's the charm. Eagle One.
Yes, I'm beginning to hate Skype with even more passion than I've hated other entities like that. So on my cell phone, which seems to be working.
Well, You sound like Wall of Voodoo's Mexican radio, but it is clear. It's okay.
Well, I'm beginning to think that since Microsoft, didn't Microsoft buy Skype?
Yeah, probably. They put it on Windows 8.
I'm beginning to sense a problem here.
However, I'm actually using Skype to call in too, so I don't know. I have
well, maybe it's just me.
So, when did you drop off? I was kind of going down a rabbit hole there with Iran.
So I don't know. I was going to. You mentioned something which triggered. We need to talk about energy self-sufficiency, and you were talking about something that triggered that thought in my mind. I don't remember what it was, but
fracking.
We,
fracking.
Yeah, it could be.
And not anyway,
well, you know, the question is that you were talking about fracking and how what you know people are trying to. The Greens seem to be very much against it. Now, here's a chance for the U.S. to attain North America certainly to attain energy self sufficiency, and even be a net exporter. And the question is, how does that change the way we approach international maritime security if we can eliminate some of the pressure from in the Middle East? It's probably a topic for an entire show, but I'm going to throw that out at you right now.
Well, I think you have a couple things working here. One thing is inertia. We have decided that that part of the world deserves its own fleet, its own focus. You know, regardless of what changes and how we get our energy and our economic partners get their energy, I think as long as we have capability to be there, we can be there. I know there's a lot of nationality depending on clothes about having to go from 2.0 to 1.0 off of Iran with a carrier. We get 2.0 there just out of inertia reasons. I think it's very defensible going back to 1.0, especially now that I don't like it, but sometimes reality is what it is. This is the last, we're coming up in a couple of months on the last fighting season in Afghanistan. This fighting season, based upon some of the decisions made recently, all it's going to do is set conditions to retrograde home. That's we're trying to do our own friendship bridge type of graceful exit. And we all know what's going to happen once we leave there anyway. So, go to 1.0. I don't think there's any reason to make extraordinary efforts in Afghanistan anymore. You're not going to create any effects that you want to. What is China and India willing to do? I think it goes back to that inertia concept again. There's a lot of, not just in Europe, which have become, you know, bosses in it, but there's a lot of global security free riding on what the U.S. has done. I don't think you'll see India and China in any way stepping into any type of gap that we create there until there is a threat to their economies. And unless somehow India and Pakistan started getting each other's face and China decided to play with that, I don't see that coming into play in any way, shape, or form. So maybe we just do a slow fade in that area. We'll never leave it, no more than the Brits have ever left it. But maybe it'll just do a slow fade. The only thing that I think will change that is in the not unlikely event we see some type of civil war breakout in Saudi Arabia. I think that's one of the great potential game changers that some people are looking at, some smart people are looking at, but generally off everybody's radar screen. Huge potential for a civil war in Saudi Arabia. That would affect the global economy, therefore it would affect us. But is there anything we could do about it? I hope not. I thought Iraq was a mess. You go into Saudi Arabia with ground troops, and you'll regret the minute you did that.
Well, that kind of throws we haven't really talked about Syria much, and if depending on what happens in Syria, does that impinge on what might happen next in Saudi Arabia?
Yes, in this respect. And I think we got a little smart here in Syria, and I'm actually believe I'm pretty full on it with the president on this. Tunisia, not so much, but definitely in Egypt and also in Libya. The Arab Spring has just turned out, springtime of Salafists and the Muslim Brotherhood. That we're only in Act 2 of a multi-act play there, and none of it's going to be for us. And in Syrian civil war, the Syrians are going to fight it out. We haven't even begun to see the beginning of the bloodletting then. People think it's going to stop when Assad goes. They're high. The Alawites and the Shia in Syria will be massacred on a wholesale level, as will Christians. You'll see what Christians are left in that part of the world, in Lebanon and in western Syria. They will be left in heat as well. They've already had some bloodletting there. It's going to get worse. And I just think we need to stay out of it. We don't need to have any of that blood on our hands. The blood's going to be there anyway. We're not going to be able to have any type of effects on the ground. It's going to have to work itself out. The important thing is that we do what we can do to stop the blowback from being as tough as possible, probably along the lines of what we see Israel doing. They've had to take out a few strategic locations here and there that involve weapons of mass destruction. And the best thing we can do is have some mitigation in play in case some of those WMDs do end up going someplace else. But is there a way that the U.S. or Europe can move needle in Syria? I don't think we have a good track record on that. Probably the best thing we can do is contain it, let them work it out, and try to make the best of it on the other end. But I think we would be fools if we thought that we could go in there and create anything. There's no appetite and there's no history to say that there's any reason to do that. And if any foreign troops need to be on the soil there, I would let the Turkish government decide what they want to do, because that's their backyard.
Well, that raises Saturn V actually raised a pretty good question in the chat room about who the fighting parties would be in a Saudi civil war. Are you looking at a Sunni Shiite thing with
Absolutely.
A lot of stuff coming in from Iran as they try and continue, expand their domination of the Arabian Gulf?
The Shia tribes in eastern Saudi Arabia have been treated horribly from founding the kingdom. They also happen to have most of the oil fields underneath them. That's one side of the civil war. I think you also have when the Grand Mosque in Mecca was taken by the Salafists, what was that, 25 years ago? Anyway,
yeah,
you have the hardcore lobby against the practical Saudis, which a lot of us have worked with and have studied with, who are fairly urbanized and civilized people, but they're a minority in their own country. So I could very well see a multi-layer civil disintegration in that country, but it all depends upon how the Saud family, the royal family, work it, how much control they have over the National Guard, and how many inroads the Al-Qaeda affiliated other Salafists, Muslim Brotherhood, that whole gaggle of goo, how much inroads they've been able to make into civil society. Maybe what's going to happen in Yemen be a catalyst for that? I don't think we know. We're horrible at figuring out that type of tribal society, but the Ottomans couldn't figure it out. The Brits couldn't figure it out. I don't think we're going to be able to figure it out either. We're just going to have to wait and see what happens. And again, try to contain any of the after effects that take place. Nations and people and cultures are allowed to have civil wars and to slaughter each other. They always have. They always will. I think Echo powers at their own peril trying to interject or host up or down harder, because eventually that pressure is going to manifest itself.
Well, I mean, the point. I mean, here's Turkey sitting there with a few hundred thousand refugees on their land now. I mean, they, of all the entities down there, would seem to have the most interest in some kind of peaceful resolution of what's going on, relatively peaceful, of course. But, you know, as you've already said, we've got Lebanon with its issues, many of which are Syrian-related, and there's a whole lot of other stuff going on down there, and Syria is the major Iranian ally on that particular piece of dirt. So how bad could this get if things really went south here?
I think the worst thing that could happen would be if either party started lobbying chemical and maybe biological weapons around in the civil war. I think in there, the estimates on how people have been killed are all over the place. But in most civil wars, I think the Russian civil war from 1917 on, I think, is a good example of this. It reaches a certain point, so much bloodshed has taken place that the usual governors of behavior are pulled out, and it becomes medieval. I think if that takes place, Israel, rightfully, they've got their list of targets. They're not going to get involved on the ground except perhaps creating additional buffers outside Golan. They're gonna strike everybody who seems to have those weapons, because Israelis, rightfully, I'm concerned. Those things go into Lebanon, they get into Hezbollah camps. It's not going to take too much with the technology they have right now to lob them into Tel Aviv, Haifa, any of those places. The Israeli people have a little touchy thing about being gassed. I think that would be good at all. I think it would be incredibly foolish, unless it was a false flag operation, to have some of those weapons fall on the Turkish side of the border. That's just insane. I think it's important to watch the Turks, though, because they know that part of the country better, that part of the world better than anybody else. Not that it affect their border well, but they know the personalities, they know the characters. They have a colonial history there as well. So I would defer to the Turks on what's going on in Syria, but I would watch Israel very, very closely. I think one of the third-order effects of this whole evolution is people think that Israel is ever going to give the Golan back to Syria. No way. They're not never going to give up the high ground. Anybody who is thinking about that fantasy between what has happened in Gaza, in the Sinai in the last 18 months, and what has happened in Syria has just reminded everybody of how critical geography is. And a small nation needs their buffers. I think we have probably seen, at least in our lifetime, the end of land peace and a little bit of a hardening of position, realizing that they're in a crappy part of the world and they just have to make the best of it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I tend to agree with you. So as we near the end of our show, and I want to thank you for playing today, What are you working on? We're going to see the next couple of weeks on your blog.
Oh wow! Kind of caught me blindsided. I have a lot of things in draft. One of the interesting things that I'm working on is there's a little bit of an underground at the Naval Academy that sends me some goodies now and then. Usually just on background, but. Some interesting things have happened where some smart midshipmen, as is the best of their generation, they like to speak up. The women being allowed to go in all combat, and I think Chairman Joint Chiefs of Staff said, well, maybe we'll just make the standard less. Ask a very good question in a format that they have there where you have midshipmen ask questions and get answered by other, more senior level midshipmen. It's very interesting, some of the mental gymnastics that people are doing, saying that Well, we can't have one standard, but we can't lower the min standard, because if we lower the min standard, then we've lowered the standards that we don't need. Very interesting, because I've always supported women serving wherever they can, but I'm watching some of the mental gymnastics now that they've taken down some of the other barriers. That's one of the things that I'm looking at bringing up at the camp. And I'm also looking at kind of what we started the line with today, looking at the French experience in that part of Africa. And also, I think I want to talk about SW, is some people are starting to appreciate the fact that the Chinese are getting a critical mass of different layers of competence with their submarines, but also the national will to perhaps do a little more out-of-area operations that potentially could get us flat-footed. Is I think we've gotten a little covered with vines and flat-footed in ASW, so that'll be fun to watch. How about yourself?
Well, I'm continuing a thing on aquaculture after I cranked it up a few months ago and then abandoned it, and I'm bringing it back because 50% of the seafood that's eaten now is farmed, basically. And to me, it's really an interesting area because I think it also changes the potential sea areas of concern, and also has a lot to do with the future of the way we feed our population if we don't go the Soylent Green route. So I'm working on that.
Hey, I can't believe I forgot this. Speaking of green, had a Navy captain that is playing for the other team with the Air Force has put out a really interesting article that pokes a finger in the forehead of SecNav Mavis's green Navy routine and talks about alternative fuels and things of that manner. I've managed to get his extended report. Saw a report's coming out. I know this is an area you're interested in, anyone. So I'm going to try to get enough time to put it up on Scrib so people can read the whole thing, to get a couple of pull quotes out of it, a few facts that'll push back against the spin of wearing little green helmets all over the place at sea. That I thought was very interesting and mature pushback on his part.
Yeah, we need to close it down, but I did, to go along with that thought, though, I did see a piece by a former governor of Pennsylvania, I think it was, arguing that that the sequestration shouldn't affect this move to manufactured fuels. Of course, he happens to be working for one of those companies that's working along those lines now, but just an interesting thought.
Yeah, the money thing.
Okay, well, everybody's going to have to catch up with this this last part on this show on the overrun time, so.
Yeah, we can keep going. Hey, those that obviously are getting us on the archive, thank you very much for joining us for a free-for-all today, and we look forward to seeing you on another edition of MidRats. And, hey, listen to it like we started it. If you're not following Eagle One himself on Twitter, please do, because we always put some stuff up there that we might not actually put up on our blog. So thanks a lot, Eagle One, and enjoy the end of winter.
Have a good night.
Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.